9. You'll make yourselves at home. Hollis said you might come over here to interview me and find out about my fascinating life, Stans said. And Colin sat down on a musty couch, not unlike the one in which he and K-19 had shared their first kiss. Lindsay introduced Colin and Hassan, and then Colin started asking questions. The room was not air-conditioned, and as Colin pressed the record button of the digital mini-recorder and placed it on Stans' coffee table, he felt the first bead of sweat form on his neck. It would be a long day. "When did you first come to Gutshot?" Lindsay asked. "I was born in the country. 1920. Born here, raised up here, always lived here, and gonna die here, I'm sure," he said, and then winked at Lindsay. "Oh, Stans, don't say that," Lindsay said. "What the hell would I do round here without you?" "Probably run away with that Lyford boy," Stans answered. Stans turned to the boys and then said, "I don't think too highly of that boy's daddy." "You just want me all to yourself," Lindsay said, laughing. "Tell us about the factory, Stans." "These boys ain't ever been." Around Stans, for some reason, Lindsay spoke with a thick accent. "The factory opened up 3 years before I was born, and I worked there from when I was 14. I suppose if I hadn't, I would have farmed. That's what my father did until the factory came along. We did everything back then, T-shirts and handkerchiefs and bandanas, and it was hard work. But your family was always fair. First, Dr. Dinson Farr, and then his son-in-law, Corville Wells, and then there was that sumbitch Alex, who I know was your daddy, Lindsay, so you'll have to forgive me. And then Hollis, who took good care of every one. I worked in that factory 60 years to the day. I have the world record. They named the break room after me because that's where I spent most of my time." His upper lip smiled, but Stans' jawless chin couldn't follow suit. Already the house felt like a hot tub without the water and the bubbles. "This is a hard way to make $100, Colin thought. "You'll want some tea?" Stans asked. Without waiting for an answer, he stood up and walked into the kitchen. At once sweet and bitter, it tasted a little like lemonade, except somehow more grown up. Colin loved it. It was everything he hoped coffee would be, and helped himself to several glasses while Stans talked, pausing only to take his medication once, and to go to the bathroom 4 times. Old people do that. They seem to love bathrooms. "Well, the first thing that you have to understand is that in the country, we weren't ever poor. Even in the Depression, I wasn't ever hungry, because when Dr. Dinsenfar had to lay people off, he never fired more than one person from a family." Something about Dr. Dinsenfar led Stans elsewhere. "You know, they've been calling the country Gutshot for a long-ass time. And Lindsay, I bet you don't even know why." Lindsay shook her head politely, and Stans leaned forward out of his lazy boy and said, "Oh, see? Now you'll haven't heard a damn thing about the place, then. Back in the old days, so old that even this old man weren't born yet, prize fighting was illegal. And if you wanted to break the law, Gutshot was a fine place to do it. Always has been, really. I saw the inside of the Carver County Jail a few times myself, you know. I was drunk in public in 1948. I was a public nuisance in 1956, and then I was in jail for 2 days on illegal discharging of a firearm when I killed Caroline Clayton's rat snake in 1974. Mary wouldn't bail me out after I killed that godforsaken snake, you know? But how on earth am I supposed to tell it's a pet? I go into Caroline Clayton's house looking for the hammer she borrowed from me 6 months before, and there's a by-God rat snake slithering across the kitchen. 'What would you do, son?' he asked Colin. Colin mulled the situation over. 'You went into someone else's house without knocking?' he asked. 'No, I knocked, but she weren't at home.' 'That's a crime also,' Colin pointed out. 'Trespassing.' 'Well, thank the Lord you didn't arrest me, boy,' Stans said. 'Anyway, you see a snake, you kill it. That's how I was raised up. So I shot it, split it right in two. And that evening, Caroline Clayton come over to my house. She's passed on now, bless her heart, and she's screaming and crying that I killed Jake, and I told her someone else must have killed Jake, whoever the hell he was, because all I did was shoot up a goddamn rat snake. But then it turns out that Jake was the snake, and that she loved it like the child she never had. She never married, of course. Uglier than sin, bless her heart.' The snake probably didn't care that she was ugly, Colin pointed out. They have very poor eyesight. Stans looked over at Lindsay Lee Wells. Your friend here is a regular fountain of knowledge. He sure got is, she said, drawling. What was I talking about? Asked Stans. Gutshot, boxing, the old days, Colin answered quickly. Right, yes, well, it was a town for trouble back then before the factory brought in families. Just a rough sharecropper town. My mama told me that the town didn't have no name. But then they started bringing in boxers. Boys from all over the country would come here and they'd fight for $5 or $10, winner take all, and make extra money betting on themselves. But to get around the prize fighting laws, they had this rule that you couldn't hit below the belt or above the shoulders. Gutshot boxing. The town became famous for it, and that's what we got called. Colin wiped the back of his sweaty palm against his sweaty forehead, spreading the moisture around rather than truly dealing with it, and took several gulps of tea. Mary and I got married in 1944, Stans went on, when I was supposed to go off to the war, and Colin thought Stans might benefit from a lesson from his 11th grade English teacher, Mr. Holtzclaw, who taught them about transitions. Colin couldn't tell a story to save his life, admittedly, but at least he'd heard of transitions. Still, it was fun to listen to Stans. Anyway, I didn't go off to war because I shot off two of my toes, because I'm a coward, and I'm an old man, so I can tell you that frankly. I wasn't afraid of war, you know. War never scared me. I just didn't want to go all the way hell over there to fight one. I had a reputation after that. I pretended I shot myself by accident, but everyone knew. I never did lose that reputation, but now most everyone is dead, and y'all ain't got any stories from them, so you have to believe mine by default. They were cowards, too. Everyone is. But we got married, and, oh Lord, we sure loved each other, or always did, till the very end. She never liked me much, but sure she loved me, if you know what I'm saying. Colin glanced at Hassan, who glanced back, his eyes wide in horror. They both feared they knew exactly what Stans was saying. She died in 1997, heart attack. She was nothing but good, and I was nothing but bad, but then she died, and I didn't. He showed them pictures then. They crowded around his lazy boy as his wrinkled hands flipped slowly through a photo album thick with memories. The oldest pictures were faded and yellowing, and Colin thought about how even in pictures of their youth, old people look old. He watched as pictures moved to a crisp black and white, and then to the bland colour of Polaroids. Watched as children were born and then grew up, as hair fell out and was replaced by wrinkles. And all the while, Stans and Mary stayed in the pictures together, from their wedding to their 50th anniversary. I'll have that, Colin thought. I will have it. I will. With Catherine. But I won't only be that, he resolved. I will leave behind something more than one photo album where I always look old. Later, Colin knew their 6 hours were up when Lindsay Lee Wells stood up and said, Well, we gotta get going, Stans. All right, he said. Good to have you. And Lindsay, you look just perfect. You need an air conditioner, bud. It's awful hot in here, and Hollis could get you one no problem, Lindsay said. I get by all right. She's done good by me. Stans stood up and walked them to the door. Colin shook the old man's shaky hand. In the hearse, Colin drove as fast as the roads would permit, with the windows down to try and cool off. Hassan said, I think I just lost 60 pounds in sweat. Then you could stand to stay out in the heat a while longer, Lindsay said. That was the easiest $100 anyone ever made in Gutshot. Hey, no, don't turn. I need you to take me to the store, so we can all hang out with the other Colin in the sweet, sweet air conditioning. Lindsay shook her head. Uh-uh. You get to drop me off, and then you get to make yourself scarce until you pick me up in 2 hours, and then you tell Hollis that we've spent the afternoon running round the country. Well, said Hassan, sounding somewhat annoyed, we will certainly miss your abundant charm and bubbly personality. Oh, I'm sorry, she said. I'm just kidding around. Anyway, I like you, Hassan. It's the smarty pants I find unbearable. Colin glanced through the rear view into the back seat. She was smiling at him with her lips closed. He knew she was kidding, or thought she was, but he still felt anger rise up in his throat, and he knew the hurt was betrayed in his eyes. Jesus, Singleton, I'm just kidding. You've got to remember that usually when he hears a girl call him unbearable, it's the last words of a Catherine, explained Hassan, talking like Colin wasn't behind the wheel. He's pretty touchy on the whole subject of his being unbearable. Dingleberries, said Colin. Gotcha. After dropping off Lindsay, they ended up back at Hardee's, eating a mid-afternoon snack of double cheeseburgers and fries, limp with the weight of their own grease. Colin read from Byron for the first 30 minutes, while Hassan repeatedly sighed and said, God, you're boring, until finally Colin put the book down. They still had an hour to kill when the meal was over. Standing in the parking lot, with the heat radiating in waves off the pavement, Hassan wiped his forehead and said, I think we should stop by the Gutshot General Store. They pulled into the store's dirt parking lot 50 minutes early and strode up the staircase into a blast of air conditioning. Behind the counter, Lindsay Lee Wells was sitting on what appeared to be a boy, who had an arm draped across her lap. Hello, said Colin. TOC peeked out from behind Lindsay. He nodded at Colin without smiling or blinking, or in any way moving any of the muscles in his strong, round face. What's up? Said TOC. Not much, said Colin. You're a lucky couple of guys get to live with Lindsay. Lindsay let loose a chirpy laugh and contorted herself to kiss her boyfriend sweetly on the neck. Oh, we'll live together one day, she said. If you touch her, TOC said out of the blue, I'll kill you. That's a little cliched, Hassan called out from the candy aisle. And if we touch her? I mean, what if I brush up against her as we walk through a hallway? TOC glowered. Well, he said, this has been fun. But Lindsay and I were in the middle of a very important talk, so if you wouldn't mind. To diffuse the tension, Colin said, Oh, sorry. Yeah, we'll just, take a walk or something. Here, Lindsay said and tossed them a set of keys. Colin's truck has AC. Don't take that truck out of park, TOC said gruffly. And they walked out the door. Colin heard TOC ask Lindsay, Who's the genius? The fat one or the skinny one? But he didn't hang around to hear Lindsay's response. As they walked across the dirt parking lot towards TOC's SUV, Hassan said, God, he's built like a brick shithouse, isn't he? Listen, the fat one's going to take a piss in the field. The skinny one will wait for the fat one in the truck, Colin said. Colin climbed in, turned the key and put the AC on full blast, although at first it only pumped out hot air. Hassan opened the passenger door and immediately started talking. She's so bubbly around him, but then around us she's just one of the guys, just slinging shit, and then around Stan she was all yawling it up and talking southern. Do you have a crush on her or something? Asked Colin suddenly. No, I was just thinking aloud. For the last time, I'm not interested in dating a girl I'm not going to marry. Dating Lindsay would be haram. Also, she's got a big nose. I don't go in for noses. Well, not to start an argument, but you do all kinds of shit that is haram. Hassan nodded. Yeah, but the haram shit I do is like having a dog. It's not like smoking crack or talking behind people's backs or stealing or lying to my mum or fugging girls. Moral relativism, Colin said. No, it's not. I don't think God gives a shit if we have a dog or if a woman wears shorts. I think he gives a shit about whether you're a good person. The words good person made Colin immediately think about Catherine 19. She would be leaving Chicago soon for a camp in Wisconsin, where she worked every summer as a counselor. The camp was for kids with physical disabilities. They taught them how to ride horses. She was such a good person, and he missed her all over his body. He missed her like crazy cakes. But he felt, in the throbbing, missing piece inside of him, that she didn't long for him like that. She was probably relieved. If she were thinking of him, she'd call. Unless... I think I'm going to call her. That's the worst idea you've ever had, Hassan replied immediately. The worst idea ever. No, it's not. Because what if she's just waiting for me to call, like I'm waiting for her to call? Right, but you're the dumpy. Dumpies don't call. You know that, Kafir. Dumpies must never, never call. There's no exception to that rule. None. Never call. Never. You can't call. Colin reached into his pocket. Don't do it, dude. You're pulling the pin on a grenade. You're covered in gasoline and the phone is a lit match. Colin flipped over open the phone. Dingleberries, he said. Haslam threw up his hands. You can't dingleberry that. That's a flagrant misuse of dingleberry. I dingleberry you calling her. Colin closed the phone and mulled it over. Pensive, he bit the inside of his thumb. Okay, he said, sliding the phone back into his pocket. I won't. Hassan sighed heavily. That was a close one. Thank goodness for the double reverse dingleberry. They sat in silence for a moment, and then Colin said, I want to go home.
To Chicago?
No, to Lindsay's. But we still have 40 minutes to kill. Hassan stared out through the windshield and nodded his head slowly. After a few quiet moments, he said, Okay, okay. Fat kid asthma attack. It's an oldie, but it's a goodie.
What?
Hassan rolled his eyes.
What, are you deaf? Fat kid asthma attack. It's the oldest trick in the whole fat kid book. Just follow my lead.
They got out the car, and Hassan started wheezing very loudly. His every inhalation sounded like the cry of a dying duck. Exhale. Exhale. He pushed his hand against his chest and ran to the Gutshot General Store.
What's wrong with him? Lindsay asked Colin.
Before he could answer, Hassan started talking amid his wheezes.
Asthma.
Attack.
Bad one.
Oh shit, Lindsay said. She hopped off TOC's lap, turned around, grabbed her first aid box, and started looking through it in vain for asthma meds. The other Colin sat silently on the stool, no doubt displeased by the interruption. He'll be fine, Colin said. It happens. I just need to get him home to his inhaler. Hollis doesn't like it when people show up when she's working, Lindsay said.
Well, she'll make an exception, said Colin.
Hassan kept his wheezing for the drive home, and as he raced up the Pink Mansion stairs and into his room, Colin sat with Lindsay in the living room. They could both hear Hollis in the kitchen saying, This is an American product. It's made with American labor. That's a selling point. That's a marketable, promotable facet of our product. People buy American. I've got a study here. Colin had wondered whether maybe Hollis just watched the Home Shopping Network all day and left other people to run the business. But obviously she did work. Hollis came out to find them and the first thing she said was, Please don't interrupt me during working hours. And then Lindsay and Hassan had an asthma attack and forgot his inhaler, and then Hollis took off quickly running up the stairs. Colin followed, shouting, I hope you're okay, Hassan, so that Hassan would know she was coming, and when they all got to his room, he was lying peacefully on the bed.
Sorry, I forgot my inhaler, he said. It won't happen again.
They ate a dinner of hamburgers and steamed asparagus in the Wells family backyard. Colin's backyard in Chicago measured 12 feet by 10 feet. This backyard went on for football fields. To their left, a hill rose to its peak, the forest broken up only by a few rocky outcroppings. To their right, a well-kept lawn stretched down the hill towards a soybean field. We'd found out from Sotans that they were soybeans. As the sun set behind them, a citronella candle burned in a bucket in the centre of the table to ward off mosquitoes. Colin liked how Gutshot felt wide open and endless. When he finished eating, Colin's mind returned to Catherine 19. He glanced at his phone to see if she'd called, and noticed it was time to call his parents. For whatever reason, Colin could never get reception in this house in the third largest city in America, but had all five bars in Gutshot, Tennessee. His father picked up. I'm still in the same town as yesterday. Gutshot, Tennessee, Colin began. I'm staying with a woman named Hollis Wells.
Thank you for calling on time. Should that name be familiar to me? Asked his dad.
No, but she's listed in the phone book. I checked. She owns a factory here. I think we're going to stay here a few days, Colin said, fibbing. Inexplicably, Hassan loves it here, and also we seem to have gotten a job.
You can't stay with strangers, Colin.
Colin considered lying, staying in a hotel, working in a restaurant here, getting my bearings, but he told the truth.
She's nice. I trust her.
You trust everyone.
Dad, I survived 17 years in Chicago without ever getting mugged or stabbed or kidnapped or falling onto the third rail or get... Talk to your mother, he said, which is what his dad always said. After a few moments, Colin could just see them talking whilst his dad held his hand over the receiver. His mum picked up. Well, are you happy? I wouldn't go that far. Happier? His mum tried. Marginally, he allowed. I'm not lying face down on the carpet. Let me talk to this woman, his mum said. So Colin walked outside and found Hollis on the couch and handed the phone to her. After just talking to Hollis, it was decided he could stay. He knew that his mum wanted to have an adventure. She'd always wished he could be a normal kid. Colin suspected she'd be secretly pleased if he came home one night at 3 in the morning reeking of booze, because that would be normal. Normal kids came home late. Normal kids drank warm 40s of malt liquor in alleys with their friends. Normal kids have more than one friend. His father wanted Colin to transcend all that stuff, but maybe even he was starting to see the unlikelihood of Colin ever becoming extraordinary. Colin walked up to Hassan's room to tell him his parents were cool with him staying, but Hassan wasn't home. He hunted around the cavernous house, eventually making his way downstairs, where he found a closed door with Lindsay's voice emanating from behind it. He stood in front of the thin door and listened. Right, but how does he do it? Does he just memorize everything? Lindsay said. No, it's not like that. It's like if you or me sat down and read a book about, say, the presidents, and we read that William Howard Taft was the fattest president, and one time he got stuck in a bathtub. That might click in our brains as interesting, and we'd remember it, right? Lindsay laughed. You and me will read a book and find, like, 3 interesting things that we remember. But Colin finds everything intriguing. He reads a book about presidents, and he remembers more of it, because everything he reads clicks in his head as fucking interesting. Honestly, I've seen him do it with the phone book. He'll be like, oh, there are 24 listenings for Tischler. How fascinating. Colin felt an odd mix of feelings, like his talent was at once being inflated and ridiculed. It was true, he guessed, but it wasn't just that he found things fascinating in and of themselves and could memorize the whole phone book because he made for such excellent literature. He found stuff fascinating for a reason. Like, take for example, the Tischler thing, which happened to be true, and Hassan remembered it correctly. Tischler was the German word for carpenter, and when he was looking through the phone book that day with Hassan, Colin thought, how strange that there would be exactly 24 German carpenters in Chicago when the all-night manicure place on the corner of Oakley and Lawrence is called 24/7 Nails. And then he got to wondering whether there were exactly 7 carpenters of some other language in the Chicago phone book, and it turned out that there were precisely 7 carpenteros. So it wasn't just that things interested him because he didn't know them from boring. It was the connection his brain made, connections he couldn't help but seek out. But that doesn't explain why he's good at, like, Scrabble, Lindsay pointed out. Right, well, he's good at that because he's ridiculously good at anagramming. But anything he takes up, he just works insanely hard. Like typing. He didn't learn to type until 9th grade, when we were friends. Our English teacher required typewritten papers, so, like, over 2 weeks, Singleton taught himself to type. And he didn't do it by typing his English papers, because then he wouldn't have been good enough at typing. What he did is he sat down at his computer every day after school and retyped Shakespeare's plays. All of them, literally. And then he retyped The Catcher in the Rye, and he kept retyping and retyping until he could fucking type like a genius. Colin backed away from the door then. It occurred to him that he'd never done anything else in his whole life. Anagramming, spitting back facts he'd learned in books, memorizing 99 digits of an already known number, falling in love with the same 9 letters over and over again, retyping and retyping and retyping and retyping. His only hope for originality was the theorem. Colin opened the door and found Hassan and Lindsay sitting on opposite sides of a green leather couch in a room dominated by a pool table with pink felt. They were watching poker on a huge flat-screen TV hanging on the wall. Hassan turned around to face Colin. Dude, he said, you can see all their zits.
Colin sat down between them. Lindsay and Hassan talked about poker and zits and HD and DVR whilst Colin graphed his past. By the end of the night, a slightly tweaked formula had worked for two more Catherines, 9 and 14. He barely registered the change when they turned off the TV and started playing pool. He just kept scribbling. He loved the scratching of pencil against paper when he was this focused. It meant something was happening. When the clock read midnight, Colin put his pencil down. He looked up at Lindsay, who was standing on one foot, bent over the pool table at an absurdly awkward angle. Hassan seemed to have left the room. "Hey," said Colin. "Oh, you're out of the Twilight Zone," she said. "How's the theorem?" "Okay. I don't really know if it'll work yet. Where's Hassan?" "He went to bed. I asked if you wanted to play, but I don't think you heard me, so I figured I'd just play against myself for a while. I'm beating me pretty handily." Colin stood up and sniffed. "I think I'm allergic to this house." "It could be Princess," Lindsay said. "This is actually Princess's room." "Shh, she's sleeping." Colin followed Lindsay to the pool table and knelt down beside her. Beneath the table, a large sphere that initially seemed to be a ball of shaggy carpet grew and shrunk, rhythmically breathing. "She's always sleeping." "I'm allergic to pet dander," Colin announced. She smirked. "Yeah, well, Princess lived here first." She sat back down with him, her legs tucked beneath her so that she seemed taller than Colin. "Hassan told me you're good at anagramming," she said. "Yeah," Colin answered. "Good at anagramming? Dragon maggot mania." Lindsay's hand, she painted her fingernails an electric blue since yesterday, was suddenly against his forearm, and Colin tensed up from the surprise. When he turned his head to look at her, she placed her hand back in her lap. "So," she went on, "you're a genius at making words out of other words, but you can't make new words out of thin air." And yes, again, that was it exactly. A retyper and not a writer. A prodigy and not a genius. It was so quiet that he could hear Princess breathing, and he felt the missing piece inside him. "I just want to do something that matters, or be something that matters. I just want to matter." Lindsay didn't answer right away, but she leaned in toward Colin, and he could smell her fruity perfume. And then she lay down next to him on her back, the crown of her head just brushing against his shorts. "I think we're opposites, you and me," she said finally. "Because personally, I think mattering is a piss-poor idea. I just want to fly under the radar, because when you start to make yourself into a big deal, that's when you get shot down. The bigger a deal you are, the worse your life is. Look at, like, the miserable lives of famous people. Is that why you read Celebrity Living?" Lindsay nodded. "Yeah, totally. There's a word in German for it. God, it's the tip of a Schadenfreude," Colin said, "finding pleasure in others' pain." "Right. So, anyway," Lindsay went on, "take staying here. Hollis always tells me that nothing really good will ever happen to me if I stay in Gutshot, and maybe that's true. But nothing really bad will ever happen either, and I'll take that bargain any day." Colin didn't answer, but he was thinking that Lindsay Lee Wells, for all her coolness and whatever, was a bit of a wimp. Before he could figure out a way to say so, Lindsay sat up, animated by a new topic. "Okay," she said. "Here's the thing about storytelling. You need a beginning and a middle and an end. Your stories have no plots. They're like, here's something I was thinking, and then the next thing I was thinking, and then etc. You can't get away with rambling. You're Colin Singleton, beginning storyteller. You've got to stick to a straight plot. And then you need a good, strong moral, or a theme, or whatever. And the other thing is romance and adventure. You've got to put some of those in. If it's a story about peeing into a lion cage, give yourself a girlfriend who notices how gigantic your winky is, and then saves you from the lion at the last second by tackling you, because she's desperate to save that gorgeous, ginormous winky." Colin blushed, but Lindsay kept going. "In the beginning, you need to pee. In the middle, you do, and in the end, through romance and adventure, your winky is saved from the jaws of a hungry lion by the pluck of a young girl motivated by her abiding love for giant winkies. And the moral of the story is that a heroic girlfriend, combined with a giant winky,
will save you from even the most desperate of situations. When Colin finished laughing, he placed his hand on top of Lindsay's. It stayed there for a moment, and he could feel the worn place on her thumb where she nibbled at it. He pulled his hand away after a moment and said, "My theorem will tell the story. Each graph with a beginning, a middle, and an end." "There's no romance in geometry," Lindsay answered. "Just you wait." The beginning of the middle. He never thought much about Catherine the First. He only felt upset about the breakup, because that's what you're supposed to feel. Little kids play house, they play war, they play relationships. "I want to go with you. You dumped me. I'm sad." But none of it was really real. Because Catherine's dad was Colin's tutor, Colin and Catherine continued to see each other periodically over the next 7 years. They got along well, but it's not like he burned with longing for her. He didn't miss her enough to become obsessed with her name, to date her namesakes over and over and over and over and over again. And yet, that's what happened. It didn't seem willful at first. It was just a series of odd coincidences. It just kept happening. He'd meet a Catherine and like her. She'd like him back, and then it would end. And then, after it ceased being mere coincidence, it just became two streaks. One, dating Catherines, he wished to keep, and one, getting dumped by them, he wished to break. But it proved impossible to divorce one cycle from the other. It just kept happening to him, and after a while, it felt almost routine. Each time he'd cycle through feelings of anger, regret, longing, hope, despair, longing, anger, regret. The thing about getting dumped, generally, and getting dumped by Catherine's in particular, was how utterly monotonous it was. That's why people grow weary of listening to dumpees obsess over their troubles. Getting dumped is predictable, repetitive, and boring. They want to stay friends, they feel smothered. It's always them and never you, and afterwards you're devastated and they're relieved. It's over for them and just starting for you. And to Colin's mind, at least, there was a deeper repetition. Each time, Catherine's dumped him because they just didn't like him. They each came to precisely the same conclusion about him. He wasn't cool enough or good-looking enough or as smart as they'd hoped. In short, he didn't matter enough. And so it happened to him again and again until it was boring. But monotony doesn't make for painlessness. In the 1st century CE, Roman authorities punished St. Apollyona by crushing her teeth one by one with pliers. Colin often thought about this in relationship to the monotony of dumpings. We have 32 teeth. After a while, having each tooth individually destroyed probably gets repetitive, even dull. But it never stops hurting.